Welcome to another episode of the Reformation Roundtable podcast. My name is Joe Stout, and this podcast is a ministry of Christ Covenant Church in Centralia, Washington. During each episode, you will hear the sermons, liturgy, discussions, and interviews from the various weekly gatherings here at Christ Covenant Church. If you would like to find out more, please visit us online at ChristCovenantCentralia.com. Please enjoy the following audio.
All right, so Daniel 2, and I'm going to start, this is a really long chapter, I'm going to start in verse 31 and go through verse 45. So this gives us, so you got the visual, if you want to look at it, and then we're going to hear Daniel describing it. So let's read this together. So Daniel 2, starting verse 31, it says, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom, inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. And as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken or brittle. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure." All right. So there's the actual text, and then you can see the artist's rendering of what this image might have looked like. And the reason why I want to think about this image with you is because we talked about pre-mill, a-mill, post-mill eschatology stuff 2 weeks ago, and as I was first studying eschatology and thinking about what do I think about, when does God's kingdom come, what is still to happen in the future, what is still in the past, it was actually this chapter in Daniel that was instrumental in changing my mind or kind of persuading me of the position that I currently hold as a post-millennial interpreter of the book of Revelation. And if you read the book of Revelation closely, you'll notice that there's lots of images and things that are drawn just straight out of Daniel. So a lot of people, they try to interpret Revelation without knowing the rest of the Bible inside and out. And that's a great way to make yourself look really silly. So you actually, before you ever pick up Revelation and try to interpret it, you gotta go back and you gotta do Daniel, you gotta do Ezekiel, you gotta do the Olivet Discourse before you get to a very symbolic and exceedingly difficult book of the Bible like Revelation. So there are two kind of questions I want to ask and try to answer during our time. And the first is gonna sound a little strange to you unless you were there a couple weeks ago when I during the last sermon. And my first question is, what is the oikumene? The oikumene. So you didn't hear me say oikumene when I just read Daniel 2, but if you were to hear the Greek text of what I just read, you would have heard this Greek word oikumene, and this is a very important word in the New Testament and in understanding biblical eschatology. So there's a reason why all of these notes are printed online, because some of this stuff gets technical, but I want to give you a really important piece of the eschatological puzzle by getting you a grasp of what is the oikumene. What is the oikumene? So here we go. The Greek word oikumene is a very important term in eschatology, and one cannot understand biblical eschatology without first grasping its signification. So there are three basic definitions for this Greek word oikumene. The first is that it just refers to the earth or the whole world in its broadest and most generic sense. And you could find many examples of this in the Psalms, Psalm 18, Psalm 50, and you can find some examples of this also in the New Testament. So in Acts 17, 31, Paul says, he's preaching in the Areopagus, and he says, because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness, and the English word world there in Greek is oikumene. So there's a sense in which Paul is talking about the final judgment, this day of judgment, and he says it's going to be a judgment on the whole oikumene. So there's one example, and there are others, of oikumene just referring to the whole world. So where a lot of people, you can find this with biblical commentators, pastors, they think that just because a word, or a Greek word, or a Hebrew word, is used to mean something in one place, that therefore it has to mean that everywhere. Okay, this is just like it's a logical fallacy, it's an exegetical fallacy. So you have to go and look at the context and see what is the sense in which this word world is being used, just like you and I use the word world in many different ways, right? We might go to a big football game in a small town and feel like, yeah, we might say the whole world was at that football game. And we're speaking hyperbolically, right? We're trying to make a point. We're trying to overstate it. We're not being literal. So there's a sense in which that's one of the ways the Bible also uses certain words in that kind of broadest sense. Let me give you the two other significations or definitions of oikumene, which are more pertinent to our text in Daniel. So the second one is that the oikumene can refer to the inhabited earth or the dwelling places of man, perhaps what we would just call civilization. So you know, you drive across the country and there are many places that are wilderness, just empty land. And you're like, we are not gonna run out of land to put people, okay? There's plenty of land. How do you get water there? That's a question. But we know what it means to be driving through civilization and then to be in a place without civilization. And that's one of the senses of oikumene. So it's referring to the place where people are, not Antarctica. Okay. The third definition, which overlaps a little bit with definition number two, is the one that we find in Daniel and also in the New Testament. And it, in this sense, oikumene can have the added specificity of referring to the nations of the world empire established by God here in Daniel 2. So by the time of the New Testament, I think I said this in maybe the sermon or a couple weeks ago, in Luke chapter 2, verse 1, it talks about a census that Caesar Augustus sent out to have done. And it says it was a census of the whole world, the whole oikumene. Well, we know where the Roman Empire's boundaries were. We know there were people who lived outside of those boundaries. But the Bible says the whole, at least your Greek, your English translation will say world, to have the whole world taxed and do a census. So there's an example of oikumene being used in this very specific sense of essentially all the places that Rome rules. So oikumene in this sense is whoever is under the authority of one of the kingdoms that Daniel 2 is describing. Okay, so here's another way of putting it. The establishment, oikumene, in this third definition, refers to the establishment of a spiritual, political world empire. That's what Daniel 2 is giving you. So remember, there's going to be roughly 400 years of no prophetic revelation between Malachi and John the Baptist. And yet, so in a lot of people's heads, that's just kind of a blank time in the timeline of like what happened from creation and up until Christ. A lot of people just kind of have a mental blank there. If you want to fill in that blank, all you have to do is read Daniel, because Daniel is being shown and being told and interpreting everything that's going to happen to the people of God from the time that they return from exile, rebuild the temple, and then the prophecies of the Christ finally coming. So this is, what you're seeing here is the oikumene. What is this a picture of? Well, it's a picture of a bunch of things, actually. This is why God gives an image, because an image is multivalent. There's different angles. You can reflect on this image, the different metals, the order of things, and then God is going to actually stack another image on top of this in Daniel 7, when he is going to also connect each of these kingdoms with a crazy wild beast of some kind. So this is part of why Daniel is a difficult book, because you're hearing something that someone saw, and then Daniel's interpreting some of it, but also he's not going to give you every single detail. Remember, there are times when Daniel sees things and he just is like, I don't know. I fell on my face. So if Daniel didn't know what he saw, it might be hard for us to know as well. So in Daniel 2:38, when it says, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, that's where you find this Greek word oikumene there. So notice that what Daniel is seeing when he sees this image is that God has made Nebuchadnezzar king of kings. So this is a new thing that God is doing in history, where before there's all these different nations with a king. And now God is establishing an empire. So here's a way of thinking about the biblical history. It's kind of a mnemonic. So you could think of the story of biblical history moving from tribes to kings to empires. So there's an age of tribes, an age of nations or kingdoms, and then there's an age of the empire or the oikumene, which is what Daniel 2 is describing. So from Abraham to David, who's kind of the first, you know, Saul was a king, but David's like the real king that God chose and made a covenant with. And this is still a time where even the monarchy is just arising, but it's still a very tribal time. So this is the book of Judges. People are doing what is right in their own eyes, and there's this need for some level of centralization. Some level of centralization, and God gives that to them with a king. a highly regulated kingdom. After this kingdom era, during the kingdom era, you have Jerusalem become the central city. So that's the first time where God says, you guys have been wandering around with a tent, and it goes here, it goes there. Hey, the Philistines capture it sometimes. I'm going to make a central sanctuary, and this is Solomon's temple. So Solomon's temple marks kind of this new era in the history of Israel where, all right, now it's like a fixed place. God is going to make his house here, and we're in this era of kings, and then there are going to be wars between different kingdoms. And then what you have in really the prophetic era with the book of Esther and the book of Daniel is because Israel is not doing what they're supposed to do in evangelizing the nations, they've apostatized, the kingdom has divided, God continues to move things forward, and he establishes, it says, you know, he raises up this pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar. He eventually is going to convert him, but at the time, you know, he's an idolater, probably like a Zoroastrian or something, and he is ordaining Nebuchadnezzar to be his hammer. And this is what the book of Jeremiah is all about. So the book of Jeremiah is God's explanation. Hey, I'm going to raise up Babylon. They're going to come and they're going to hammer. They're going to be my instrument of discipline. And then you get to the very end of Jeremiah, and then God says, and then when I'm done using Babylon as my hammer, I'm going to shatter the hammer. So this is also what you see in the book of Daniel. Remember when the finger comes and writes on the wall, mene, mene, tekel, parson. So Nebuchadnezzar is converted in Daniel 4. So Nebuchadnezzar becomes a Christian. Okay, you'll see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. After Nebuchadnezzar passes away or dies, eventually his son apostatizes, and then that's when you have Cyrus the Persian come in that very day and takes over Babylon. So we actually have even the beginnings of this image starting to play out within the book of Daniel, and Daniel lives through it. So Daniel's one of those guys, so he was like in his 80s when he went into the lion's den. So he was not a young man. This was towards the end of his life. And so you have, in Isaiah actually calls Cyrus, and I believe it's Isaiah 45 or 46 in there. Cyrus is God's anointed. He is God's Messiah. He's the Christ. So remember, the Davidic king, David, there was a covenant with him, and God promised to Solomon, if your sons keep covenant with me, I will establish their throne forever. And yet, the kings were taken off into exile. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar captured Zedekiah, put out his son's eyes. They dragged off Jehoiachin into Babylon. And from that point on, the question, if you're a Jew, is, well, who is going to be the anointed king? And so this is one of the problems that the prophets are trying to answer. And Isaiah says, since you guys apostatized, God is actually going to ordain this Gentile, Cyrus the Persian, to go and build a house for my name, to rebuild the temple. So this is Ezra, Nehemiah, this is Esther. This is what God does. So you actually have God, the part of the book of Daniel is knowing like God is in control of who's in charge. So he ordains Nebuchadnezzar, he calls him King of Kings, and then after the gold head kind of falls, now you're in the Persian era with Cyrus, and then eventually they're going to fall, and you're gonna have the rise of Greece, Alexander the Great. You get all of that history in there. I'll pause there for a moment. Are there any just questions? I know that I'm throwing a lot at you guys. Ava.
So if the statue of Nebuchadnezzar was a pyramid from the heaven, then why did they make the feet like that are supporting the whole statue out of clay and iron? Because that seems like it would just collapse.
So Ava's question is, are you asking, is this image, did they actually build this statue, or? Okay, so they did not build this statue. This is just a picture of, well, this is just a picture, but the image in Daniel 2 is not something that they literally constructed with those materials afterwards. However, you might be thinking, are you thinking of when he builds the idol of himself and commands Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to bow down to it? Is that what you're thinking of?
I thought that's what that statue was.
Okay, so those are actually two different things, but you can see why Nebuchadnezzar might have done, so that one was, I believe it was all gold. But you can see why he would do that. God told me, I am the gold head. Why shouldn't you bow down to me? So there's a question for you. You're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Here's God's anointed, well, he's not totally anointed. Here's God's appointed king. And yeah, bow down to the image. Well, of course, they rightly do not bow down to the image. So does that clarify? So this what he sees in his image is what Daniel 2 is describing. And then the statue he builds is something different. Andrew?
So oikumene, meaning world, or at least translated as world, why don't we see more translations than translating for sense? Because even in, I think even in the NIV, they don't really translate that word into something more specific, I guess is what I'm looking to say, to where it would say civilization or nation, but they choose to translate it pretty consistently world. Is that because there is some discrepancy or disagreement as to how, like, the parameters of the word?
Yeah. This gets into the question of, like, what is a good translation philosophy, which is a hard question, right? So a short answer is, so I use the King James for many reasons. At some point, I'll explain them all to you. One of the reasons why I will just read the New King James. I won't tell you, but sometimes I do. But one of the reasons why I would not want the New King James to be kind of like the standard Bible we use is because the translators are not like neutral people who have no opinion. And they were mainly dispensationalists who translated the New King James. So they did a pretty good job. They at least used the correct Greek manuscripts to translate from. But this would be one place where they have all the little chapter headings or the section headings, and you're going to get their theology of the translators. So some of it is just ignorance, that there is this distinction. And I think this is one of the reasons why when you talk about are you a futurist or a preterist, as we saw, if you're reading, Jesus is saying the gospel has to go out to the whole world, and you think the gospel has not gone out clearly to every single nation, therefore it must be future. This would be a good example of why it'd be very easy to be misled into a futurist reading. And it is extremely hard to translate the Bible. And it's like, yeah, what would you use? Would you use empire? Would you use kind of a weird hyphenated word and it would read awkwardly? Or do you put it in the margin, something like that? So that's that gets into a bigger conversation.
So to also back to the conversation that we had, there does seem to be another alternative word that gets used, which was, I believe, it's a cosmos.
Yeah, cosmos, yep.
And that comes up in like John 3:16, right?
Yep.
Where God so loved the world, so we say cosmos. So I guess as somebody who is reading it from an English perspective, are we to just then need to go back to the Greek to know which one is being used, or is there one that is more frequently used? How are we to understand that?
Yeah. Well, that's why we're doing this. Once upon a time, there would be no way for you to know. You would just have to trust your Bible translators. So we're living in a time of kind of revolution when it comes to reading text, that anybody could at least look up in, you know, a Strong's dictionary and just see what's the Greek word underneath this word world. Is it cosmos? Is it oikumene? However, that often makes people more dangerous. It's dangerous to do word studies like that if you don't know. And if there's one thing I've learned learning languages, it's just that like Greek is a really, really hard language. Hebrew is an exceedingly large hard language. And we need kind of an aristocracy of scholars who are just going to dedicate themselves to that. And it's hard to be really good at eschatology and these other things and also be an amazing Hebrew translator or a Greek translator. So I think eventually it's amazing that right now at least I can pull up on my phone the Greek text, multiple Greek texts, multiple commentaries on the Greek text, and same for the Hebrew, which for most of church history, they could not do that. So I think the more practical way of learning to read your Bible is you go to church and you have a person like me who is qualified to actually tell you the language, what's going on language-wise, and I'll also tell you where my limits are and just say, yeah, I don't know. I'd have to ask someone who knows better. So, and if you have a good, if I'm showing you my work, right, there's no funny business. This is why I put all my notes up here. So it's like, you could cross-check it. You could look at it. These aren't infallible notes. I'm going to make mistakes. But it's all there out in the open, and you could, and I even try to put, annoyingly perhaps for some, the Greek or the Latin or the Hebrew actually in the text. So if someone knew the language, they could say, he doesn't know what he's talking about, or yeah, he knows what he's talking about. Wink, did you have a question or a comment?
I just had an observation. Matthew 28:20, lo, I am with you always until the end of the world. Is that cosmos?
I believe that's actually aeon, if I remember. So that's another one. It's like, age or aeon, because sometimes translated world. So there's like three different Greek words that could be translated as world. So that makes it difficult. Yeah, when is that end? Okay, since we're almost at 7:30 and I only got through a quarter of my notes, we can continue just talk and ask questions until the kids come in, if there are any. Josh.
I don't want to derail you, but...
Yeah, derail me. That's what this time is for now.
Ocumene. I've got okay. Two really important questions. Number one, how do you spell ocumene?
In English?
Yeah, how do I know?
So... O-I-K-U-M-E-N-E.
I think I got it. Sweet. Okay.
Yeah. That's what we would call the transliteration.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that was not my real question. My real question is, so obviously Daniel was originally written in Hebrew.
Okay, so this is actually the next section in my notes.
Oh, okay.
You can stop me here. So actually, Daniel 2-7 is not written in Greek or Hebrew. It's written in Aramaic. And this is part of, I think, the argument for what is actually happening here is Aramaic or Syriac was the lingua franca of that time. And this is actually the Bible being written in tongues. So the gift of tongues is not shalalalala. The gift of tongues is actual languages with a syntax and a grammar that can be translated. And the Bible, the whole New Testament is written in tongues. It's written in Greek. The Daniel 2-7 is kind of a foreshadowing of eventually the New Testament is going to be written not in Hebrew at all, which would have been almost scandalous to the Hebrew mind. So where were you going with that? Yeah,
we're talking about oikumene,
yep,
which is a Greek word that's been Septuagint.
Yes.
That translated.
Yep.
So my question would be, well, what was the original interpretation for that word? Is where I'm going.
Right. Yeah. So you would have to. So part of it with Aramaic is you would have to look at the Aramaic, and so I could pull up and see here's what the Septuagint translators were probably looking at when they chose oikumene, and then you could just say, where is this used, and is this used anywhere else? So this is how you would at least start. That only can get you so far. We just don't, because so little of the Old Testament is written in Aramaic, just a handful of chapters, your sample size is going to be pretty tiny. So you'd have to look outside of that. I think one of the reasons why it's actually safer in this instance to use the Septuagint is because that was at least what the Hebrews were using, because they didn't know they couldn't speak Hebrew anymore. So by the time of the New Testament, it would be essentially just the scribes who knew Hebrew. Everyone else, they speak Greek. They've been Hellenized. That's actually part of what Daniel is describing, is eventually there's going to be some faithful Jews and some Hellenized Jews who learn Greek.